The third time you share a cup of tea, you become family. And for our family, we're prepared to do anything, even die. He went on, laying a hand on Greg's own. Dr. Greg, you must make time to share three cups of tea. We may be uneducated, but we're not stupid. We have lived and survived here a long time. That day, Haji Ali taught me the most important lesson I've ever learned in my life, Greg said. We Americans think that you have to accomplish everything quickly. Haji Ali taught me to share three cups of tea, to slow down and make building relationships as important as building projects. He taught me that I had more to learn from the people I work with than I could ever hope to teach them. 3 weeks later, the walls of the school were as tall as Greg's head, and all that remained was to put on the roof. The original roof beams Greg had bought had not been found in Cengese's warehouse. Greg had returned to Skardu to buy new beams with Parvi's help. But, not surprisingly, the road back to Corfe was blocked by a landslide. The jeeps carrying the beams could not get through. But help showed up in the morning. Haji Ali somehow heard about our problem, and the men of Corfe had walked all night, Greg said. They arrived clapping and singing and in incredible spirits for people who hadn't slept. Greg was most amazed of all to see that Shirtaki, the mullah or religious leader of Corfe, had come along as well. Mullahs are not supposed to do physical labor. Their jobs are to pray, study, and teach. But Shirtaki insisted on helping to carry the beams back to Corfe. He wouldn't back down, and he led our column of 35 men carrying roof beams all the way, all 18 miles to Corfe, Greg remembered. Shirtaki had polio as a child, and he walked with a limp, so it must have been agony for him. But he led us up the Braldu Valley, grinning under his load. But not everyone was as pleased with the school as Shirtaki. A week later, as Greg and Twaha stood watching the roof beams being laid into place, a band of men crossed the bridge and entered Corfe. Greg followed Haji Ali out to see who the strangers were. Five men were approaching. One, who walked in front, seemed to be the leader. Four others walked behind him, carrying clubs that they smacked against their hands with each step. Twaha leaned toward Greg. "This man, Haji Mehdi, not good," he whispered. Greg already knew Haji Mehdi, the chief of Eskoli, and considered him a criminal. He demanded some of the money earned whenever any of the Balti sold a sheep, a goat, or a chicken. If someone in Eskoli sold supplies to mountain climbers and didn't give Haji Mehdi his share, the chief would send his men to beat them with clubs. Haji Mehdi refused an invitation to drink tea. "I will speak out in the open so you all can hear me," he said. "I have heard that an infidel has come to poison Muslim children, boys as well as girls, with his teachings. Allah forbids the education of girls, and I forbid the construction of the school." "We will finish our school," Haji Ali said, "whether you forbid it or not." Greg hoped to calm things down. "Why don't we have tea and talk about this?" he suggested. "I know who you are, kafir," meaning infidel, said Mehdi. "I have nothing to say to you." He turned to Haji Ali. "And you, are you not a Muslim? There's only one God. Do you worship Allah or this kafir?" Haji Ali clapped his hand on Greg's shoulder. "No one else has ever come here to help my people. I've paid you money every year, but you have done nothing for my village. This man is a better Muslim than you. He deserves my devotion more than you. If you insist on keeping your kafir school, you must pay a price," Mehdi said. "I demand 12 of your largest rams." "As you wish," Haji Ali said, turning his back on Mehdi to show how disgusted he was that the other chief had demanded a bribe. He ordered the villagers to bring out their prize rams. "You have to understand, in these villages, a ram is like a firstborn child, prize cow, and family pet all rolled into one," Greg explained later. "The most sacred duty of each family's oldest boy was to take care of their rams, and they were devastated." Haji Ali took 12 of the rams and tied their bridles together. The boys who took care of the animals cried as they handed them over. He led the line of rams to Haji Mehdi and threw the lead rope to him without a word. Then he turned his back on the other chief and gathered the people of Corfe at the side of the school. "It was one of the most humbling things I've ever seen," Greg said. "Haji Ali just handed over half the wealth of the village to that crook, but he was smiling, as if he'd won a lottery." Haji Ali stood before the building everyone in Corfe had worked so hard to raise. It had snug stone walls, plastered and painted yellow, and thick wooden doors to keep out the wind. Never again would the children of Corfe kneel over their lessons on frozen ground. "Don't be sad," Haji Ali told the crowd. "Long after all those rams are dead and eaten, this school will still stand. Haji Mehdi has food today, but our children have education forever." After dark that evening, by the fire in his house, Haji Ali beckoned Greg to sit beside him. He picked up his Quran. "Do you see how beautiful this Quran is?" he asked. "Yes," Greg answered. "I can't read it," he said. "I can't read anything. This is the greatest sadness in my life. I'll do anything so the children of my village never have to know this feeling. I'll pay any price so they have the education they deserve." Sitting there beside him, Greg said, "I realized that everything, all the difficulties I'd gone through, from the time I'd promised to build the school through the long struggle to complete it, was nothing compared to the sacrifices he was prepared to make for his people. Here was this illiterate man who'd hardly ever left his little village. Yet he was the wisest man I'd ever met." Chapter 14. A Smile Should Be More Than a Memory. With the Corfe school nearly completed, Greg turned his attention elsewhere in his new role as director of the Central Asia Institute. He arrived in Peshawar, a city in the west of Pakistan, in August of 1996, looking for sites to build new schools. Peshawar is the capital of Pakistan's Wild West, and it's full of rumors and news from nearby Afghanistan. A rebel group, made up of mostly teenage students, the Taliban, had just attacked Afghanistan's government. They had taken over one large city, and rumors swirled through town of what else they had done. Some said they'd conquered the capital. Some said the leader of the government had left the country. Some said he'd been killed. No one really knew. In the middle of this chaos, Osama bin Laden, the leader of a terrorist group called Al-Qaeda, arrived in Afghanistan. He planned to make the country his new home. The very week that Greg spent in Peshawar, bin Laden called on his followers to attack Americans wherever they could be found. Greg didn't know about this. Like most Americans, he'd never heard of bin Laden. But he knew it was a dangerous time for a foreigner in Pakistan. Haji Ali knew it too. Before Greg had left Corfe, the chief had told him to be careful. "Promise me one thing," he said. "Don't go to any place alone. Find a host you trust, a village chief would be best, and wait until he invites you to his home to drink tea. Only in this way will you be safe." But Greg didn't want to wait. Tara was pregnant, and the baby was due to be born in a month. He needed to check out possible sites for new schools and then get back to the United States. So he found a fellow guest in the hotel, a man named Badam Ghul, who was from Waziristan, an area south of Peshawar. This man offered to guide Greg to his home village of Ledda. Greg accepted, even though he didn't know the man well. He was in a hurry. Waziristan was the home of the Wazir tribe. Although the area is part of Pakistan, many people there don't have much loyalty to the country's government. Mostly they are loyal to their own tribe. Greg had read that the Waziris were violent, not to be trusted, but then he had read similar things about the Balti. He thought it was more likely the Waziris were simply outsiders, people the government of Pakistan didn't care much about, people who could probably use the kind of schools the new Central Asia Institute was going to build. In the morning, Gul met Greg outside his hotel, but told him that he'd been called away on business. Luckily, the driver of their car, a man named Mr. Khan, was from a small village near Leda and could take Greg there. Greg briefly considered backing out, but he climbed into the car. They drove through a desert landscape, past forts, factories where guns were made, and towns protected by 20-foot walls with armed guards. At sunset, they arrived at Khan's village, Kot Langakel. Khan drove Greg to a large warehouse, and as they walked inside, Greg saw crates of guns and weapons stacked up around the walls, alongside boxes of Gatorade and oil of Olay. He realized that he'd blundered into a large and well-organized smuggling operation. All he could think of to do was to make the men inside this warehouse, the ones with large guns, think of him as a guest and not an enemy. He'd learned a few words of Pashto, the local language, from Khan on the drive down. He politely asked after the men's health and their families. They discussed what to do with him, and then Khan turned to his passenger. "Haji Mirza, pleased to invite you to his house," he said, referring to one of the smugglers. Greg finally relaxed. He'd be all right now. He was a guest. They left the warehouse and climbed uphill for about half an hour until they reached Haji Mirza's home, a group of buildings protected by a 20-foot wall and defended by a man with a rifle. The guard peered suspiciously at Greg, but he let him pass when Haji Mirza grunted. Greg and Khan were led to a room with thick carpets and cushions. They sipped tea and waited for 2 hours while dinner was prepared. After roasted lamb and rice with carrots, cloves, and raisins, Greg smoked a cigarette that he was handed politely, as a good guest should. One of the men rolled out a mat for him to sleep on. He hadn't done so badly, Greg thought. He'd made contact with one tribal elder at least, and tomorrow he'd ask to be introduced to others and find out how this village would feel about a school. After only 2 hours of sleep, Greg was awakened by men shouting. Confused, he woke up to find a lamp in his face and a rifle pointed at his chest. Strangers with guns pulled him up by his arms, blindfolded him, and pulled him outside, where he was pushed into a pickup truck. "We drove for about 45 minutes," Greg says. "I was finally fully awake, and I was shivering, partly because it was cold in an open truck in the desert, and also because now I was really afraid." As the truck jolted over the road, the men all around him argued in Pashto. He guessed they were discussing what his fate should be. But he couldn't understand them, and he couldn't understand how these armed strangers had broken into Haji Mirza's house with all of his guards without even firing a shot. Then he understood. His host had handed him over willingly. The truck swerved off the highway, then stopped. Greg was pulled out onto the ground. He heard someone fumbling with a lock, then a metal gate swinging open. He was pushed inside, down a hallway, and through a door. His blindfold was removed. He was in a simple room, 10 feet by 20, with a kerosene lamp burning on the single windowsill. He turned to say something to his kidnappers, but all he saw was the door closing behind them. He heard the sound of a padlock snapping shut. There was a blanket and a pad on the dirt floor at the far end of the room. Despite his fear, Greg realized that it was better to sleep than worry. He lay down and slept dreamlessly. Greg woke in the morning to find two of his captors offering him tea. He did his best to talk to them, but they stayed near the door and ignored him. Hours passed. Greg dozed, woke, dozed again. "I began to get really depressed," Greg says. "I thought this could go on for a very long time." Greg slipped in and out of sleep, finally waking to notice something on the floor beside his bed, a Time magazine. He picked it up. It was 17 years old, and it had a long article on the Iran hostage crisis. Greg read about 66 Americans who'd been taken hostage in Iran in 1979. The writer of the article didn't know it at the time, but it would be 444 days before the last of the hostages were finally released. Would he be spending 444 days in this dim, bare room? The thought was horrifying. Greg decided to follow the lead of one of the hostages quoted in the article. She had been able to talk to one of her guards in his own language, and she thought that might have helped win her freedom. Greg decided that he had to find some way to communicate with these people who'd taken him prisoner. The next day he asked for a Quran. His kidnappers brought him one. The Quran was in Arabic, which Greg couldn't read, but he turned the pages carefully. After all, Haji Ali could not read the Quran, and he did the same. 5 times a day, he prayed, as he'd been taught by the tailor in Rawalpindi on his second trip to Pakistan. When he wasn't trying to read the Quran, Greg turned to Time magazine. He decided not to read more about the Iran hostage crisis. It made him only more anxious. Instead, he studied the ads. Pictures of happy families in a new car, an ad for Chevrolet, or celebrating Christmas, Kodak Instamatic cameras, held his attention for hours. They reminded him of home, of Tara, of their child, of everything waiting for him. During his 6th day of captivity, he found tears in his eyes as he looked at an ad for a Waterpik oral hygiene appliance, a machine that squirted out tiny jets of water to scour plaque away from teeth. The ad said, "A smile should be more than a memory." As Greg was poring over pictures of a happy family with dazzling smiles, he sensed someone standing over his bed. He looked up to see a large man with a silvery beard and a kindly smile. The man greeted Greg in Pashto and then said, "So you must be the American, in English." Amazed, Greg stood up to shake his hand. The room spun around him. For the past few days, as he'd felt more and more depressed, he'd eaten nothing but rice and tea. Now he was dizzy from hunger. The man grabbed his shoulders, steadying him, and called for breakfast. Between mouthfuls of warm chapati, Greg made up for 6 days without speaking. When he asked the kindly man's name, the stranger paused for a moment before saying, "Just call me Khan." In Waziristan, Khan is as common as Smith in America. But Greg didn't care what the man wanted to be called, if he would only listen. Over pots of green tea, he explained about the work he'd done in Baltistan and the many more schools he'd hoped to build for Pakistan's children. He'd come to Waziristan, he explained, to see if anyone here needed his help. He hoped Khan would say that the whole thing had been a mistake, that he was free to go, but Khan simply picked up the Time magazine and looked through it. "My wife is about to give birth to our first child, a son," Greg added, "and I need to get home for his arrival." Actually, the baby Tara was carrying would be a girl. Greg knew this. "But I knew that for a Muslim, the birth of a son is a really big deal," he said later. "I felt bad about lying, but I thought that the birth of a son might make them let me go." Khan continued to look through the magazine, frowning. "I told my wife I'd be home already," Greg continued. "I'm sure she's really worried. Can I telephone her to tell her I'm all right?" "There are no telephones here," said Khan. "What if you took me to one of the Pakistan army posts? I could call from there." Khan sighed. "I'm afraid that's not possible," he said. Then he looked at Greg in the eye before gathering the tea things and taking his leave. "Don't worry," he said. "You will be just fine." 2 days later, Khan appeared again. "You are a fan of football?" he asked. "Sure," Greg said. He told Khan he'd played football in college. Only after he'd said it did he realize that Khan, who'd learned English in a British school, meant the game that Americans call soccer. "Then we will entertain you with a match," Khan said, beckoning Greg toward the door. "Come." Greg followed Khan out of the front gate and felt dizzy at a wide open space all around him. He thought about making a run for it, but remembered that there was a man armed with a gun on a tall tower behind him. So instead, he sat in a small plastic chair and watched 2 dozen young, bearded men play a game of soccer on a wide, stony field. Their goalposts were made of stacked aluminum crates. But before the game was over, the sentry on the tower called out. He'd seen some movement at a nearby army post. "Terribly sorry," Khan said as he herded Greg quickly back behind the compound's high walls. That night, Greg couldn't sleep. Was the soccer match a sign that he'd be released soon? Or had they decided to let him have a few moments outside before they killed him? When men arrived at his cell at 4 a.m., he thought he had his answer. Khan put a blindfold on Greg, draped a blanket over his shoulders, and led him outside to a pickup truck. Greg expected to be murdered. "I didn't think being shot was such a bad way to die," he said. "But the idea that Tara would have to raise our child on her own and would probably never find out what had happened to me made me crazy." For the half hour that they drove, Greg pulled the blanket tightly around his shoulders, but couldn't stop shivering. When the truck came to a stop and he could hear the sound of guns being fired, he broke out into a sweat. But then, Khan unwrapped Greg's blindfold and hugged him. "You see?" he said. "I told you everything would work out for the best." Over Khan's shoulder, Greg saw hundreds of Wazir men dancing around bonfires, shooting off their guns, not in attack, but in celebration. There were pots boiling and goats roasting over the flames. "What is this?" he yelled, following Khan off the truck. "Why am I here?" "It's best if I don't tell you too much," Khan settled. He told Greg that his fate had been decided by Jirga, or a village council, and that they were throwing a party. "A party before we take you back to Peshawar," Khan explained. At first, Greg didn't quite believe him, but he realized it was true when one of his former guards stumbled toward him, grinning, and stuffed a handful of rupee notes into the pocket of his shalwar. "For your school," Khan shouted in Greg's ear. "So, inshallah, you'll build many more." Chapter 15. A Picture. Greg made it to Montana by September, just in time for the birth of his daughter, Amira Eliana. Amira was born at their home, and after her birth, Greg lay in bed with Tara and the baby and placed the multicolored tomar that Haji Ali had given him around his daughter's neck. But he couldn't stay in his cozy house with his wife and new daughter forever. Jean Herney called, demanding to know when Greg would have a picture of the completed Corfe school to show him. He was so impatient that Greg asked what was bothering him. Herney admitted that his doctors had told him that he had leukemia, a cancer of the blood. He might live only a few more months. "I must see that school before I die," Herney said. "Promise me you'll bring me a picture as soon as possible." "I promise," Greg said. Greg left the country only a few weeks after Amira's birth, determined to keep his promise to Herney. In Corfe, it was clear and cold. Greg and the village men wrapped blankets over their shalwars and fitted the roof beams in place. It was too cold now to sleep on the rooftops, so Greg slept inside Haji Ali's house, along with the family and the animals they owned. "We were all worried about Dr. Greg sleeping inside with the smoke and the animals, but he seemed to take no notice of these things," Twaha remembered. "We saw he had peculiar habits, very different from other Europeans. He made no demands for good food and environment. He ate whatever my mother put before him and slept in the smoke like a Balti. Due to Dr. Greg's excellent manners, and he never tells a lie, my parents and I came to love him very much." One evening, Greg sheepishly confessed the story of his kidnapping in Waziristan to Haji Ali.
"You went alone?" Haji Ali accused him. "You didn't seek the hospitality of a village chief. If you learn only one thing from me, learn this lesson well. Never go anywhere in Pakistan alone. Promise me that."
"I promise," Greg said.
"Where will you build your next school?" Haji Ali asked.
"I thought I'd travel to the Hussein Valley," Greg said. "Visit a few villages and see who..."
"Can I give you some advice?" Haji Ali interrupted.
"Sure."
"Why don't you leave it to us? I'll call a meeting of all the elders of the Braldu and see what village is ready to donate their free land and labor for a school. That way you don't have to flap all over Baltistan like a crow again. eating here and there, Haji Ali said, laughing. So once again, an illiterate old Balti taught a Westerner how to best go about developing his backward area, Greg said later. Ever since then, with all the schools I've built, I've remembered Haji Ali's advice and expanded slowly, from village to village and valley to valley, going where we'd already built relationships, instead of trying to hopscotch to places where I had no contacts, like Waziristan. By early December, the windows in the Corfay school were in place, and blackboards were hung inside. On the afternoon of December 10, 1996, Greg crouched on the roof with Traha, Hussein, and the rest of the workers and pounded in the last nail. The first snowflakes of the season swirled down. Haji Ali cheered from the ground. "I asked Almighty Allah to delay the snow until you were done," he said, grinning. "And in his infinite wisdom, he did. Now come down and take some tea." That evening, Haji Ali unlocked the cupboard inside his house and gave Greg back his level and plumb line. Then he handed him a notebook. Greg turned the pages, amazed to see rows of numbers. The village had accounted for every rupee spent on the school, adding up the cost of every brick, nail, and board, and the wages paid to put them together, he said. And they did a much better job of it than I ever could have. Back in the United States, Greg drove from Montana through a blizzard to reach the hospital in Haley, Idaho, where Jean Herney was staying. The snow made driving slow, and he finally got there at 2 a.m. Herney was awake, sitting up in bed. "You're late," he said. "Again." When Greg asked how he was feeling, he didn't answer. He just wanted to know if Greg had brought him a picture of Corfay School. Greg put an envelope into his hands and watched his face as he opened it. Jean Herney pulled out an 8x10 photograph of Corfay School that Greg had taken the day he left. "Magnifique," meaning magnificent, he said, nodding at the sturdy, pale yellow building with fresh crimson trim. He traced his finger along the line of 70 ragged, smiling students who were about to begin their education, safe, warm, and indoors for the first time. Herney called a nurse and asked her to bring him a hammer and nail. All she could get was a stapler. Greg pulled a watercolor picture of two kittens off the wall and stapled the picture of the school where Herney could see it from his bed. Greg turned back to Herney and saw him on the phone with an overseas operator. He was calling a childhood friend in Switzerland. "It's me, Jean," he said in French. "I built a school in the Karakoram," he boasted. "What have you done for the last 50 years?" For the last few weeks of Herney's life, Greg became his nurse. It was the final time he would work as a nurse, and he was glad he knew how to make his friend comfortable. He also hooked up a video camera to the hospital television and showed Herney movies he'd taken of village life in Pakistan. Herney lay in bed, holding Greg's hand, watching as Corfay's children sang "Mary Had a Little Lamb" in their less-than-perfect English. Jean didn't go quietly. He was angry about dying, Greg said. But as he watched the children sing, his anger drained away. He said to Greg, "I love you like a son." Before he went into the hospital, Herney gave the Central Asia Institute $1 million. He wanted to ensure that the organization was on solid ground, just like the Corfay School. After he died in January of 1997, the Institute would be able to continue the vision that Herney and Greg had started together. Chapter 16. New Schools and More. Greg set up an office for the Central Asia Institute, or the CAI, in the basement laundry room of his house. Since there is a time difference of 12 hours between Pakistan and Montana, where he now lived, he would make his first phone calls of the day around 9 at night to catch people in the morning in Pakistan. Then he'd go to sleep for a few hours, waking at 2 or 3 in the morning to make more calls, reaching people in Pakistan before they went home for the day. One of the first people he hired to work for the Institute was Ghulam Parvi, who'd helped him get the supplies for Corfe's school out of the hands of Shengezi. Musafir also worked for the CAI now, along with Haji Ali, Twaha, and other people Greg had met in his travels in Pakistan. It had taken 3 years to get Corfe's school completed, but the Central Asia Institute finished its next three schools in 3 months, including one in Changezi's village of Kwardu. And it built more than just schools. While Greg was spending some time in Corfe, meeting with Haji Ali, Twaha, and Hussein, two women approached them. Sakina, Haji Ali's wife, and Hawa, Hussein's wife, boldly sat down with the men. "We appreciate everything you've done for our children," Hawa said, "but the women want me to ask you for something more." Life in winter was hard for the women in Corfe, Hawa and Sakina explained. Trapped inside their homes by freezing weather, they had little to do and no chance to talk to each other. "Allah willing, we'd like a center for the women, a place to talk and sew," Hawa said. By the summer of 1997, an unused back room in Haji Ali's house had become the Corfe Women's Vocational Center. With 4 new sewing machines and lessons from a nearby tailor, the women of Corfe had a place where they could gather and work to help them earn a little money for their families. That summer, Greg, Tara, and Amira, just 8 months old, traveled to Pakistan. In August, they traveled up to Corfe for a ceremony to celebrate the school's opening. It was incredible to finally see the place Greg had talked so passionately about for years, Tara says. The day of the inauguration, we met Haji Ali and his wife, and the whole village competed to take turns holding a mirror. The school had been freshly painted for the occasion and hung with banners and Pakistani flags. There were new wooden desks, thick carpets to protect the children's feet from the cold, and books to make a school library. Jean Herney's widow was there to give each child a new school uniform. "It was the most exciting day of my life," said Tahira, the daughter of Hussein. "Mr. Parvi handed each of us new books, and I didn't dare to open them. They were so beautiful. I never had my own books before." Twaha's daughter Jahan was excited too. "I couldn't take my eyes off all the foreign ladies," she said. "They seemed so dignified." Before the school opened, when she'd seen people from downside or below the mountains, she'd felt shy. "I'd run away," she explained, "ashamed of my dirty clothes. But that day, I held the first set of clean new clothes I'd ever owned, and I remember thinking, maybe I shouldn't feel so ashamed. Maybe one day, Allah willing, I can become a great lady too." There were speeches from Haji Ali, from Hussein, and 2 other teachers who'd been hired to work with him, and from many others who'd come to see Corfe's school. But one person didn't speak, Greg Mortensen. While the speeches went on, Greg stood in the background against the wall, Tara remembered, holding a baby someone had handed him. It was the most filthy baby I'd ever seen, but he didn't seem to notice. He just stood there happily, bouncing it in his arms. Greg showed Tara and Amira around Baltistan. After his wife and daughter returned to the United States, he stayed 2 months more to help organize a new project. With the help of Muzaffar and Tara's brother, a climber who'd reached the peak of Everest, Greg created a school for Balti porters. They were trained in climbing, administering first aid, and rescuing people who were lost or injured. The school also tried to repair some of the damage to the environment done by climbing expeditions. Every year, they organize a trip to take away tin cans, glass, and plastic trash from base camps in the mountains. The camps were cleaned up, and the porters sold the recyclable materials, earning some extra money that they badly needed. Word of what the Central Asia Institute was doing spread. When Greg returned to Skardu the next spring, people arrived at his hotel to talk to him or hand him badly spelt notes asking for help with anything from starting a mining business to rebuilding a mosque. He didn't have time to speak with everybody who came to see him, and he started to eat his meals in the hotel kitchen, hiding out where no one could find him. He sorted through all the notes and requests, trying to find the projects, that the CAI could handle. Greg also came to know a religious leader in Baltistan, Sayyid Abbas Rizvi, who agreed with him that education was important, but pointed out that the children in the area needed something else too, clean water. In some villages, he said, more than a third of the children died before they were a year old, many because they didn't have clean water to drink or bathe in. Greg agreed that this was something the CAI could help with. After all, a plant had to be watered before it could grow, and children had to survive long enough to be able to go to school. With Sayyid Abbas, Greg visited the chief of a village called Chunda and asked for the help of the people there. Four nearby villages heard what was happening and asked to join in. With hundreds of workers digging for 10 hours a day, trenches were finished and pipes were put into place to bring fresh spring water to the villages. The CAI planned to build three more schools in the summer of 1998. Greg was most interested in the school for Musafir's village. Musafir was not as strong as he had once been. He had seemed to grow old all at once and was getting more and more deaf. Greg found a piece of open land in Musafir's village between two groves of apricot trees. 3 months later, a school was standing there. Despite his age, Musafir carried rocks to the construction site and raised roof beams into place. Standing with Greg in front of the finished school, as the children peered on tiptoe through the glass windows at the mysterious rooms where they'd begin getting their education in the fall, Musafir took his friend's hand. "I'd like to work with you for many more years," he said, "but Allah, in his wisdom, has taken much of my strength." Greg hugged him. "What will you do now?" he asked. Musafir said he would spend his time working in the gardens and orchards of his town. "My work now," he explained simply, "is to give water to the trees." One June day in 1998, Greg was trying to start a new school to be built in Kane, the village where his K2 expedition cook lived. But arguments were still going on there over what kind of school he should build, a climbing school or a school for children. As Greg was trying to sort things out, a man bumped up in a borrowed jeep. He introduced himself as the chief of a village called Huse. "I've been trying to meet you for 1 year now," he said. "Please, in evening time, you come to Huse and attend our tea party." The chief's name was Muhammad Aslam Khan. When he was a boy, his father had woken him up early one morning and told him that he was leaving the village. "Why do I have to go?" Aslam asked, crying. "You're going to school," his father said. Aslam's father walked with him down their mountain until the trail ended at a river with no bridge. Aslam couldn't swim, but he clung to goat bladders, blown full of air to stay afloat, and kicked his way across the icy water. A stranger on the far bank pulled him out and wrapped him in a blanket as he shivered and cried. When Aslam told the stranger that he'd crossed the river to go to school, the man comforted him. "Don't be afraid," he said. "You're a brave boy to come so far from home. One day, you'll be honored by everyone when you return." Alone, Aslam made his way to a large town and was enrolled in a government school. When he graduated years later, he was at the top of his class. He was offered a job in government, but turned it down to return to Huse and become the chief of his village. He got the government of Pakistan to build a road to Huse and even a school, so that other children would not have to leave home as he had done to get an education. But the building was badly constructed, and only boys could study there. "I've been blessed 9 times, Aslam said, "with 5 boys and 4 girls. But my daughter Shakila is the most clever. There was nowhere for her to pursue her studies, and she was too young to send away. I began to hear rumors about a big Angrezi who was building schools that welcomed boys and girls all over Pakistan. I decided to seek him out." Aslam was surprised after meeting Greg. "I expected to have to plead with an Angrezi sahib like a little man," he said. "But he spoke to me as a brother. I found Greg a very kind, soft-hearted, naturally pleasing man. Every year since we built our school, this feeling gets stronger, and finally, that love has spread to all my children and all the families of Husay. After sipping butter tea and talking with Aslam deep into the night, Greg agreed to give up the idea of a school in Kane and build one in Husay instead. In 1998, the year it was finished, Aslam's daughter Shakila was 8 years old. At first, when I began to attend school, many people in the village told me a girl has no business doing such a thing, Shakila said. They said you will end up working in the fields like all women, so why fill your head with the foolishness found in books? But I knew how much my father valued education, so I tried to shut my mind to the talk, and I persisted in my studies. After she finished Husay School, where she was the top student, Shakila left home to go to high school, the first girl in her town to move beyond elementary school. Greg realized that more of Pakistan's girls needed a chance like Shakila's. Once you educate the boys, they tend to leave the villages and go search for work in the cities, he said. But the girls stay home, become leaders in the community, and pass on what they've learned. He told the villages where the CAI had built schools that they must get more girls in the classrooms, 10% more every year, in order to keep getting help from the CAI. If the girls can just get to a fifth grade level, he said, everything changes. Things were certainly different in Shakila's village. She could see that for herself. People's minds in Husay are beginning to change, she said. Now, when I return to my village, I see all the families sending the girls to school. And they tell me, Shakila, we were mistaken. You were right to read so many books and brave to study so far from home. You're bringing honor to the village. Shakila dreams of going on to medical school and becoming a doctor. I've learned the world is a large place, she said. And so far, I've only seen a little of it. Holding a test on which his daughter had gotten a perfect score, Aslam said, For these blessings, I thank Almighty Allah and Mr. Greg Mortensen. Chapter 17. Running from War. For as long as Greg had been coming to Pakistan, the country had been fighting with its neighbor, India, over the region of Kashmir. Both India and Pakistan claimed Kashmir for their own. In 1999, the fighting became more serious. Troops moved into position, and the fighter jets started bombing the area. Refugees from Kashmir, fleeing the bombs and artillery shells the army were aiming at each other, began to pour into Baltistan. Greg bought a plane ticket. When he arrived, Greg spoke with Saeed Abbas. He'd never seen the mullah so upset. No one knew how many people had been injured or killed by the bombing, he said, but 2,000 refugees had already reached Skardu. Thousands of others were still near their homes, hiding in caves, waiting for the worst of the fighting to be over. They would flee Kashmir as well. Saeed Abbas had contacted several international organizations to ask for help, but the organizations had turned him down, and the local government didn't have the money or supplies to help them. What do the people need? Greg asked. Everything, Saeed Abbas said. But most of all, water. Together, Saeed and Greg went to see the refugees. Most of the refugees in Skardu were men who had left their families to come to make new homes where their wives and children could join them. They had been allowed to set up tents on land nobody else wanted, sand dunes next to the airport. There was no source of water there, and the nearest river was more than 1 hour's walk away. Greg's head throbbed. This was a huge task. How can we bring water here? He asked. We're a long way uphill from the river. Saeed Abbas thought that if they drilled deep into the ground, they might be able to pump water up. His black robes billowed as he ran ahead over the bright sand, pointing out places where he thought they might look for water deep underground. I wish that Westerners who misunderstand Muslims could have seen Saeed Abbas in action that day, Greg said. They would see that most people who practice the true teachings of Islam, even conservative mullahs like Saeed Abbas, believe in peace and justice, not in terror. While Greg and Abbas discussed water, Another CAI worker, Abu Razak, walked among the tents, talking to people, making lists of urgently needed supplies. There were more than 1,500 hungry refugees in the camp, but everyone realized that soon the number could grow to 4,000 or 5,000. Now, Apo came up to the other two men, his face serious. "Dr. Greg," he said, taking Greg's hand and leading him toward the tents. "Enough talking. How can you know what the people need if you don't ask them?" Apo led Greg to a tent. Inside sat Mullah Gulzar, the religious leader of a village called Bromo. He shook Greg's hand and apologized for not being able to make him any tea. When they were all seated cross-legged on the warm sand, the mullah told his story. "We didn't want to come here," Mullah Gulzar said, stroking his beard. "Bromo is a good place. Or it was. We stayed as long as we could, hiding in the caves by day and working the fields at night. If we had worked by day, none of us would have survived, because there are so many shells falling. Finally, all the irrigation channels were broken, the fields were ruined, and the houses were shattered. We knew our women and children would die if we didn't do something, so we walked over the mountains to Skardu. I'm not young, and it was very difficult. When we came to the Skardu town, the army told us to make our home here," he went on. "And when we saw this place, we decided to go home. But the army would not permit it. They said, 'You have no home to go back to. It is broken. Still, we would return if we could, for this is not a life. And now our women and children will soon come to this wasteland, and what can we tell them?'" Greg took the mullah's hand in both of his. "We will help you bring water here for your families," he promised. "Thanks to Allah Almighty for that," the mullah said. "But water is only a beginning. We need food and medicine and education for our children. This is our home now. I'm ashamed to ask you for so much, but no one else has come." The old man's eyes were damp with tears. "And we have nothing. For your malakang, for your kindness in fulfilling our prayers, I can offer you nothing," Mullah Gulzar said. "Not even tea." With money from the CAI, pipes and bulldozers from Skardu, 12 tractors loaned by the army, and work from the villagers of Bromo, Greg fulfilled his promise. After drilling down 120 feet, they hit water that could be pumped up to fill a tank for the camp. Now the men of Bromo could start building mud block houses for their families. But first, the women and children had to survive their journey to Skardu. Fatima Batul was one of the children of Bromo. She and her sister Amina had run for shelter in caves after bombs and shells had destroyed their homes and fields. A shell had landed near Amina before she could reach the caves. She hadn't been badly injured, but since then, she had not spoken a word. When she heard a shell explode, she would shake and whimper. "Life was very cruel in the caves," said Fatima's friend Nargiz Ali. "Our village Bromo was a very beautiful place, with apricot and even cherry trees, on a slope by the Indus River. But we could only glance out at it and watch it being destroyed." After a while, the few men who had stayed in the caves decided that the time had come to be brave and leave. They took what little food they could find in the ruins of their homes and walked away in the middle of the night. The next morning, out in the open, they were cooking bread over a fire when artillery shells began to fall near them again. Every time a shell exploded, Amina would shake and cry and fall to the earth, Fatima explained. "In that place there were no caves, so all we could do is run. I'm ashamed to say that I was so frightened that I stopped tugging at my sister and ran to save myself. I was fearful that she would be killed, but being alone must have been more frightening to my sister than the shelling, and she ran to join the rest of the village." For 3 weeks, the survivors of Bromo walked northwest, finding their way on paths made by animals, eating whatever berries and wild plants they could find, always hungry. At last they arrived in Skardu and the dunes by the airport. But it was too late for Amina. When we reached our new village, Amina lay down and would not get up, Fatima said. No one could revive her, and not even being safe at last with our father and uncle seemed to cheer her. She died after a few days. Nothing would ever make up to the refugees for their loss of their homes and so many members of their families. But Fatima's friend Nargis remembers one good thing that happened after they reached Skardu. When we arrived after our long walk, we were, of course, very happy to see our families, she said. But then I looked at the place where we were supposed to live, and I felt frightened and unsure. There were no houses, no trees, no mosque. Then Said Abbas brought a large Angrezi to talk with us. He told us that if we were willing to work hard, he would help us build a school. And do you know, he kept his chatando, his promise. Fatima and Nargis both attended the Gultori Girls Refugee School, built by the CAI and located near the Skardu airport. Their brothers walked into town each day to go to a government school. This is the first and only school the girls have ever been to. Because they started their education late, most students are 15 by the time they graduate from fifth grade. I've heard some people say that Americans are bad, Fatima said. But we love Americans. They're the most kind people for us. They are the only ones who care to help us. Chapter 18. Too much to do. Building new schools and providing teachers and educations to isolated villages and refugee camps costs money. Despite Jean Herney's generosity, the CAI needed more funds to continue on. Greg began to give talks about the work the CAI was doing. With a slide projector held together with duct tape, he traveled the country. He'd leave envelopes on the audience's chair, and after he spoke, he'd gather them up, usually with donations inside. He hated getting up in front of an audience to talk about himself, but the $100 or $200 he collected each time made it worthwhile. He knew how that money could help the children of Pakistan. But this time it looked like he wouldn't get much for his efforts. He was scheduled to give a talk about the CAI at a sports store in Apple Valley, Minnesota. But it was nearly half an hour after the time he was supposed to start, and nobody had sat down. Then two of the store's employees showed up and took seats in the last row. What should I do? Greg said. Should I still give my talk? They said he should. So Greg started in, presenting his slideshow to two people and 198 empty chairs. He showed pictures of K2 and talked about his climb. Then he began to talk about the CAI. Slides flashed on the screen of the 18 schools the CAI had built. As Greg spoke about the schools and told stories about the children who went there, including Fatima, Nargis, and their classmates, he caught the eye of a middle-aged man nearby who was quietly looking at a display of digital watches. Greg smiled, and the man sat down in the last row as well. Now with three people to talk to, Greg went on for half an hour more. He talked about the terrible poverty the children of Pakistan endure. He talked about the CAI's plan to begin building new schools at the northern edge of Pakistan, along the border it shares with Afghanistan. He finished by quoting Mother Teresa, a Catholic nun who had spent many years in India, working to improve the lives of the poor. "What we are trying to do may just be a drop in the ocean," he said, smiling warmly at his small audience. "But the ocean would be less because of that missing drop." As Greg finished, the three listeners applauded. The two store employees helped him stack up the empty chairs and pick up the empty envelopes Greg had laid on them. One of the workers offered Greg a $10 bill. He'd been planning to spend the money going out with his friends after work, he said. But if the CAI could use it... "Thanks," Greg said, shaking his hand and putting the money into an envelope. Then he went back to picking up the rest of the empty envelopes. On the last seat of the last chair in the last row, next to the display of digital watches, was an envelope with a check inside for $20,000. Greg didn't collect $20,000 every time he gave a talk, but he didn't usually face a sea of empty seats either, especially in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. He was becoming well known. Some newspapers and magazines wrote about his story. Mountain climbers in particular became strong supporters of the CAI. Alex Lowe, a famous mountaineer, introduced Greg at one event. "While most of us are trying to scale new peaks," he told his audience, "Greg has been quietly moving even greater mountains on his own. His kind of climb is one we should all attempt." In some places, when Greg Mortensen gave a speech, people were turned away because there were not enough seats. Even so, some people at the CAI were getting frustrated with Greg. He knew how to climb mountains, knew how to get schools built, but he wasn't much of a businessman. The CAI had a board, a group of people who were supposed to decide which projects to work on and how money should be spent. But Greg often got so busy that he didn't return the board members' phone calls or emails. They wouldn't hear from him for weeks. Even though he was busy, Greg also didn't want to use up precious money to hire anybody to help. He thought he could handle every project himself, but the work was too much. He didn't have enough time for every project, and he wasn't taking care of himself either, not sleeping, not exercising. "I understand that he decided to pour everything into his work," one CAI board member said, "but if he drops dead of a heart attack, what then?" Tara agreed with some of what people at the CAI were saying about her husband. She called a meeting with her husband at the kitchen table. "I told Greg I love how passionate he is about his work," she said, "but I told him that he had a duty to his family, too. He needed to get more sleep, get some exercise, and get enough time at home to have a life with us." She and Greg agreed that he wouldn't go to Pakistan for longer than 2 months at a time. Greg also began training himself to become a better manager of the CAI. He spent time in his basement reading books on management and finance. But he knew some lessons couldn't be learned from books. So he also traveled to Bangladesh and to the Philippines, hoping to learn from other organizations that helped the poor. He was very impressed with the schools that had been built for the girls in Bangladesh, one of the poorest countries on earth. "The girls' education initiative is hugely successful there," Greg says. He visited the places that had been educating girls for a long time. "I watched as amazing, strong women held village meetings and worked to empower their daughters." "They were following the same philosophy I was," he said. Nobel Prize winner Amartya Sen's idea that you can change a culture by giving its girls the tools to grow up educated so that they can help themselves. It was amazing to see the idea in action, working so well after only a generation, and it fired me up to fight for girls' education in Pakistan. In September 1997, during one of those trips, Greg's flight back to the United States stopped briefly in Calcutta, India. There, he learned that one of his heroes, Mother Teresa, had died. A nun who had dedicated her life to serving the poorest of the poor, she had founded her own order, the Sisters of Charity. Their duty, she said, was to care for the hungry, the naked, the homeless, the crippled, the blind, the lepers, all those people who feel unwanted, unloved, uncared for throughout society, people that have become a burden to society and are shunned by everyone. Greg headed to where Mother Teresa lay, among hundreds of quiet mourners. A young nun led him to the room where Mother Teresa's body was. He sat in a corner looking at her body, covered by a shroud. Greg says he had no idea what to do. "Since I was a little boy, she'd been one of my heroes. She looked so small, draped in that cloth," he said. "And I remember thinking how amazing it was that such a tiny person had such a huge effect on humanity." Even 2 years later, back home in the winter of 1999, alone in his basement office, Greg often thought of Mother Teresa and all she had accomplished. He himself was feeling tired and frustrated. He ignored the ringing telephone and emails that piled up, and focused on reading more and more about a tragedy on the borders of Afghanistan. More than 10,000 Afghan refugees, mostly women,